Hi, everyone, and welcome to our limited edition podcast for Decoded Pride Issue 2. We are super pumped to have you with us, and today we're speaking with a small round table of creators about their creative process, why queer speculative fiction matters so much, and where you can pick up our amazing new anthology. Spoiler, it's at decodedpride.com. Hey there, listeners. Welcome to our Decoded Pride Limited Series podcast. We are super pumped to have you here with us. And I am Essie Fleenor. I'm one of the editors of Decoded Pride Issue 2. I am downright giddy today. I am here with our small round table, and I am so pumped to introduce our panelists. We have S.B. Edwards, who also goes by Sophie, the author of More Efficient Than a Guillotine. What a title. We have J.D. Harlock. J.D. is the author of Love, Satan. Again, come on, people. These titles are too good. Akil Wingate, who is the author of A Murder of Crows. What's not to love about these titles? I'm already in love. Spoiler alert, listener, I've read all the stories, so I know what happens. But I am just so excited to be here with you all. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and we have you all from like all over the world. So we've got Akil, you're calling in from London. Is that correct?
No, Paris.
I'm coming from London.
Paris. Oh, sorry. Sophie's calling from London. Akil's calling from Paris. And then JD, where you're calling from? Lebanon?
Beirut. Yes. Beirut, Lebanon.
Oh my goodness. Well, I feel very lucky. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado. Not that cool, but hey, I get to talk with the cool international crowd. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. I am pumped.
To be clear, I'm from a small, boring town in Ontario called London, not the big, fancy London over across the pond.
LOL, my bad. Gotcha. Okay, still Canada, still cooler than Colorado. Come on.
And Denver sounds really, really appealing to me, especially given all the things that I could get into in Colorado, from skiing to a number of nature hikes and that kind of thing.
It is pretty amazing.
Absolutely.
You can stay with us, obviously. We have a beautiful garden. It's like it's spring, so everything's opening up. I spent like 2 hours walking around the garden going, what's that? What's that? And my partner's like, come on, we planted that last year. I'm like, I don't keep track. So anyways, amazing to have you all here. Again, thank you so much for being here. Let's launch into our first question. So I want to talk a little bit more generally to start. Why speculative fiction? As queer, as trans authors, what is it about speculative fiction that appeals to you specifically? And let's start with Sophie.
Sure. Starting off with the easy questions, huh?
nice softball.
I don't know. I mean, it's speculative fiction and sci-fi in general is such an interesting genre because on one hand, it's so forward-thinking and like by definition, it's about thinking outside of current paradigms, trying to explore new ideas and the way the world can be. But on the other hand, the vanguard of the genre has historically been cishet white dudes who are outside of their writings pretty conservative. And so part of why I enjoy writing in this genre as a queer author, and most of my stories have queer characters in them, and it almost never revolves around them being queer. Occasionally it does, but I like to just toss them in there just to kind of more to just show that we exist and we exist in any future, as well as to, I guess, just remind the current vanguard of authors that there's more to reality than the way they look at it. And does that make sense? I feel like I'm rambling at this point.
Oh, no, not rambling at all. That gave me chills. I think you're absolutely right. The future, we're in those futures, and you can't erase us just because you don't want to include us. Like, we will include ourselves. That is beautiful,
yeah.
Sophie.
And I grew up watching Star Trek anyway, so I'm very, from a very young age, I was interested in what the world can be.
Okay, so who's your favorite, or who are some of your favorite Star Trek characters?
Oh my god. Well, I mean, my favorite captain is, and this is a little controversial for some folks, but my favorite captain is Janeway. Because she's a...
My favorite captain is Janeway.
Bravo. Excellent. Yeah, I just the entire idea of imagining a future where, hey, maybe things aren't awful. Like, I don't know why that's so hard for us as a society to do, to like why we're so obsessed with staying in paradigms that very clearly don't work for anybody and or do work for a very small number of people. And I don't know, speculative fiction allows me to kind of step outside of the boring day-to-day doldrums of floating in the muck of survival and imagine a world that maybe isn't terrible.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. JD, Akil, who wants to take it next?
This is Akil speaking. For my part, when I was a student in school, the way that things such as math and science were taught was as if the bulk of my teachers were reciting something. And my father was a university president and a physics teacher, and now he's a pastor. And my mother was a pharmacist. The expectation was for someone like me and my family to go on and do something in the field of math or science or a government-related field. Yet, growing up and going to school, I always asked over and over again, why am I doing this? Why are you teaching this? Why do I need to learn this formula? Why do I need to learn this periodic table? Why do I need to learn these so-called laws of physics, etc.? Why? And the answer was always because, without any full-fleshed out explanation. And now that I'm an adult, I've heard people explain things like math and science in a way that was never explained to me when I was a kid. Where when I was a kid, I hated these subjects. And now there's something fundamentally organic about the idea of not knowing why, but being obsessed with finding out why. We're always told why things cannot be, and yet nobody ever really delves into why not. And I didn't really understand that until I was an adult. And so writing speculative and science fiction and stories that ordinarily would be considered impossible to conceive or impossible to lay out and make real, is all about being someone who goes against the grain and fighting for your truth. And as a gay man, as a part of the LGBTQ, marginalized community, as a black gay man, it's important for me to ask myself, why not? Why not this? Why not this particular, setup for a story? Why not this particular character in a story? Why not these stakes in a story? Because rules are made to be broken. And there's something to break it down to one simple thing. I remember reading a quote that said, science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. And there's no reason why all these things can't coexist and we can't sort of build worlds from our own imagination and provoke thought in the reader and generate interest in the reader and generate a sort of fervor for new stories that, rather than ask why not. And I think that's the main reason why I personally have become invested in writing, this kind of genre.
Wow. That's so beautiful. I'm so inspired. So when do you think that, like, can you think about, Akil, when was that moment? Was there a definitive moment when the why not became how your storytelling evolved?
Ever since I was a little boy, everyone around me has always referred to me as eccentric. Ever since I was a little boy, I fortunately had people in my family, my particularly the women in my family, who always encouraged me that no matter what anyone told me, I can do whatever I want to. And that gave me maybe a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, despite the fact that I would be oftentimes in a confrontation with people in authority, particularly teachers, who would tell me, no, you can't do that. And I would say to them, why not? I have every right to. Prove me wrong. And I think throughout my public school education, even in through undergrad and graduate school, it's always been sort of the same story over and over again. And it wasn't until I heard other people echo the same sentiments about maybe 18 or 19, where I finally allowed myself to just go with it, just no longer even find myself plummeting into those kinds of conversations with people who don't care. Rather than investing in the people who don't care, invest in my own sort of self-worth and my own desire to really, really, really ask these questions. Why not? Around 18 or 19. But up until that point, it was like I was going to war on a regular basis in school, writing, trying to get published, or just in general, asking questions in a church setting of pastors or religious leaders or activists or the people who were put on pedestals around me, who for some reason or another could not justify why they had so many buts or no's as caveats to the way in which they reached out to people like me. So I guess basically to say, once I got into university, it was like, okay, the gloves are off now.
I love that. And I love, you know, it really connects to what you said in the first part of your answer where you talked about being a rule breaker. And I think that's something that speculative fiction gives us really good tools to work with as queer and trans people to break rules. So, I mean, I love that. That was beautiful. Thank you so much.
I think the worst thing you can say to a curious kid is because I said so, or because that's just the way it is, or whatever. I remember hearing that a lot when I was a kid as well. And I was just like, but no, it doesn't. But why? Like, there's got to be a reason. Don't go out in the street. Why? Because you might get hit by a car. Okay, that I can understand. But like, don't do something else. Why not? Because I said so. That's not a satisfying answer. And it's never going to be for someone who's searching for those. Well, I mean, you don't even know what you're searching for when you're like 4 or 5, but searching for something deeper.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And then, you know, JD, why does speculative fiction appeal to you, particularly as a queer and or trans person?
Well, I feel like it gives me an outlet to tell stories that I otherwise wouldn't. If I was playing with real world tools, I feel like you just get to create more interesting scenarios, especially when it comes to queer stories. I feel like when queer stories are set in the real world, they're pretty limited in what they're trying to say or how they go about it. They're usually either coming out narratives or like narratives about like the oppression a queer person would face. They're fine sometimes, but when that's all the queer fiction you're taking in, it gets kind of demoralizing, and I don't feel like we're being presented with stories about queer possibility or a different way of viewing the queer experience.
I love that. I love what you said about queer possibility. And I wonder if you could expand a little bit, tell us more about what you think queer possibility means and how speculative fiction allows us to tap into that.
We can create societies where queerness is viewed differently or operates differently or is allowed to be expressed in different ways than the way they are now in the real world, where there has been a lot of progress in the last 20, 30 years, but it's still rather homogenous, especially where I'm from in the third world. Yeah, I just don't feel like the fiction I grew up with that sort of was about queerness or being homosexual was the representation I wanted or the way I wanted to view my experience as a queer man.
Yeah, When I think about, I'm not sure what your age is. I'm in my mid 30s. Oh, okay. So I'm a little bit older than you, but I think back to like the earliest representations that I had of queer folks, and it's the same thing. It's like, it's not what the sort of stories that I want to hear. I think a lot of that comes from the idea that you have to include, there has to be a reason why a character is queer. Like it's not just this character is queer because, hey, queer people exist. It's like, oh no, there's gotta be a reason, and that has to be a plot point. And like, I don't know about y'all, but my queerness is not a plot point. I just am. So it's what happens when you get queerness viewed through a cis heteronormative lens, I think.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think when it comes to the real world and setting things in a grounded reality, there just aren't that many story avenues you're presented with, especially when you're setting these types of stories in certain time periods, like the 40s, 30s, 60s, something like that.
Yeah, I think you all are hitting the nail on the head, right? Like, it's queerness is there, and speculative fiction allows us, again, gives us the tools to expand and explore our queerness and our transness in ways that maybe we can't do in more straightforward fiction. I also write straightforward fiction, so I don't think one's better or worse, but I do see for myself in speculative, there's so much room to even just twist things slightly, you know? Like, I love writing stories where it is explicitly trans or explicitly queer, and I never talk about their identity, or I only talk about it through the events that are unfolding on the page. And that's kind of what I hear y'all saying. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like how in storytelling, a story can be like an onion. And it can be peeled back layer after layer after layer after layer. And each layer, depending on whether or not you've cut the onion with a sharp knife or you've cut it with a dull knife, either way, the reaction is going to be something emotive. Whether it brings you to tears or not is up for debate. But the fact that as you peel back the layers, you know that going deeper and deeper in, you will reach a point where you are no longer unaffected. And in terms of writing speculative or writing, for my part, sometimes I write literary fiction, my identity or the identity of the character is never a device, because I've always found when certain mainstream authors, for example, have used identity as a device, it was not only insulting to me as a reader, but it was insulting to me as a human being, because it almost says to me, they don't see my humanity. And so therefore they're writing about my humanity and my existence as if it's something that they see through the caged bars of a zoo. Like a zoo animal or something, or a circus freak or what have you, that they can't possibly see themselves in my shoes and would never deign to put me in theirs.
Very, very poignant. Especially the idea of viewing us through this, like almost looking at us like a freak show, because I mean, let's be real, 100 years ago, a lot of us would have been in a freak show. I would have been, ooh, the big, weird, bearded lady. Look at her. Isn't that strange? And even though that's not the case today, we're still kind of viewed in that way. The legacy of that, those views of us from the past are still with us and probably will be with us for a long time.
And it seems to me that connects back to even your first point, Sophie, which is that when we resist these narratives by seeing ourselves in sci-fi futures, seeing ourselves in fantasy alternate futures, we break down even more of that stigma. Should we have to? Hell no. It's not my fucking problem. It's straight people's problem. Mm-hmm. But I also want to help other generations, future generations of trans and queer people not have to carry the same burdens I have.
Exactly. And that's where the, it runs into the, like, it's not my job to do this, but also somebody's got to do it. So what am I going to do? Sit here and whine about it or do something about it? I'm I don't know. I'm too impatient to sit around and wait for stuff.
Well, that one hit me right in my heart. So let's go to the next question. And Akhil, I'm thinking maybe you could start for this one. So what made you decide to submit this specific story to Decoded?
Well, this story is actually excerpted from a novel entitled A Sleep of Seasons. And this particular chapter, A Murder of Crows, deals with a little boy. Well, I guess you'd call him a man-child, so to speak. He's in the sort of in the gray zone where they're the tweens. And I personally, at that same age, had sort of begun to see myself and hear myself differently than I was told to really see myself and hear myself. And it's the best way I can relate this is in music, you have your ears in music as a musician or as a singer or as an instrument, so to speak, where you can have pitch memory or you can have perfect pitch. And one is sort of in your blood and the other one is something that you grow into. And for me, at around the same age, I sort of grew into finally being able to hear myself, hear the actual voice that came out of my mouth, sort of an unveiling or a revelation of who I actually am versus who I was told I was. And the idea of something called Decoded, or in another way of speaking, of being revealed, or of being seen, or being heard, or being newly defined, really resonates with me. And also with the arc of the main character for my story, because he himself is told that he talks a certain way, that people around him tell him, well, you talk like you have dead lice falling off of you. And I was told something similar to that when I was a little boy, but I don't think that's the reality. I think the reality is the people who were around me listening to me weren't hearing how I was talking. They were hearing something resonate within themselves that they were uncomfortable with. And that is the code that they have to break, that they have to reveal to themselves and see within themselves when they stare back in the looking glass. So fundamentally, the reason why I sent this particular story was because that is exactly what this little boy is going through. But I also imagine so many readers will equally resonate with that very same message and possibly flashback to when they first really heard themselves or saw themselves. They're coming upon the cusp of actually hearing themselves and finding themselves and seeing themselves as well.
Well, you gave me chills and I'm a little teary. That is really powerful. I mean, I resonate with that. And, you know, I'm not a black man. I am not a man. And I was so touched reading your story, I think, because you're right. There's so much of this young person, this young man, like struggling with the internal and the external and finding, at least I'm thinking, I can't wait to read the rest of the novel. Oh my gosh. Finding that voice, finding that internal, it's a cliche, but like that internal compass, that his way of needing to be and be seen in the world. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you said, let me see if I can capture it again. You said that as a boy, people were reacting to something inside them that they put on you. And I'm wondering if you could just extrapolate just a little bit more and tell us what that means.
Projection, essentially. Mm. So oftentimes when, for example, when adults tell a child that you talk a certain way and not to talk like that, or you look a certain way and not to look like that, or you shouldn't be playing with girls' dolls, or you shouldn't be wearing a girl's dress, or you shouldn't have any flair in the way that you present yourself. You should be in a box like everybody else. And the reality of it is that no, I can be whatever I want to be. The problem is that you're in the box and you don't know how to break yourself free of the box. So you're projecting onto me what you think the world needs to be. For many years as a child, I had heard this repeated over and over and over again when I was finally around people in authority or professors and what have you who would encourage me. They would say, I don't know where you've heard this from, but you need to listen to your voice and no one else's. You need to see yourself in the mirror and not anyone else's projection of how you should see yourself. It's kind of like when, for example, you hear the story of body dysmorphia with bodybuilders, where they see themselves and then they think they're too small, or they don't think they're muscular enough to compete. And so they'll overtrain and overtrain and overtrain until they've done themselves such physical damage that they're no longer able to use their physical instrument. It's kind of the exact same idea when, if we don't fight back against this outside voice telling us what our inside voice is really telling us, we do the same kind of damage to ourselves. And essentially that's what that is projection, where people will project on you all their own insecurities when you are the one that's being free. And they possibly will never, ever be free because they grew up that way.
Well, thank you for taking me through a therapy session. I just processed a lot of internal pain. That was beautiful.
Akil, I'm so glad that you said this is only a chapter in a novel, because as I was reading your story, that's what I had in mind. I was like, this is really good, but I want more. And I'm so glad to hear that there's more. So that's wonderful.
It's a part of a 4-book saga. And because we just, you know, we don't have those. We've got Harry Potter. We've got, you know, you've got, like, what was the recent series adaptation? Shadow and Bone. All these different, you know, sagas. Fantasy sagas and speculative sagas and science fiction sagas. And every time one of them comes out, I've always said to myself, but where's me? I don't see myself in any of these. You know, it's like, I don't see anybody I know in any of these. It's like we were talking about devices and, us being used as like, window dressing or fashion accessories, the so-called gay best friend. Or the, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever stereotype that the mainstream writer likes to pepper their work with. And at the same time, when we see these on film or in television or in literature, it's like we come back to ourselves and think, you know what? I don't see anybody I know in any of these pages or in any sequence on film. So how is this selling mega bucks? And being the blockbuster it is. And then at the same time, if anything, this is make-believe, whereas the speculative fiction that we all dream up is more reality. Because real people with real stakes are written into those pages. That's the kind of the big issue I always have with mainstream speculative fiction that likes to use us as sort of the background noise to their stories.
Yeah, we're background noise or like pepper. We're like a little spice to add. Mm. JD or Sophie, do one of you want to answer the what made you decide to submit this specific story to Decoded?
Yeah, so it wasn't so much my specific story. I mean, it was just I write what I write and then I look for journals that might fit it afterwards. I know some people find, they'll find like a call for submissions and be like, oh my God, I could write something really cool for that. That's just never how I've operated. When I came across your journal, I was really excited about it because I love to see, the first thing I talked about in this little podcast of ours was the idea that the vanguard of science fiction tends to be surprisingly conservative, and doesn't tend to look like us, doesn't tend to be like us. And so when I saw a speculative fiction journal geared toward queer authors, I have never before seen myself in a journal so much. And so I really wanted to be I think there's a place for queer voices to be heard outside of the community as well. I think that's important because we can't just live in our own echo chamber and wander off to start our own little queer commune in the rural part of Ontario, though so many of us would love to, I'm sure. But even though it's important to put our voices outside of the community, it's sometimes just really nice to have a space where it's your cis-hetero being cis-het is unusual as opposed to your assumed cis-het unless until proven otherwise. It's just exciting to me to have my work being showcased alongside a whole bunch of other people whose identities overlap enough with mine that it's a different experience than submitting to yet another sci-fi journal run by yet another straight white dude who doesn't get my work because he's looking at it through his own lens.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I think that's why we started Decoded, is we were, you know, submitting, but also seeing other people talking about their stories that they were submitting that we were like, this is great. This should absolutely be published. I cannot believe no one wants to publish this. And then we looked at each other and we were like, ah, shit. Okay, let's start. Let's do it. We're in. We'll do it. Of course, we're like, oh, great. Right in time for a pandemic. I think we actually released our first call for submissions the day before where we were living started to shut down. And it was just like, oh, what have we done? What have we done? But it's lovely. I mean, it's been a really incredible experience. And, you know, issue one was really special and fun. And issue two is just, oh my gosh, y'all brought your A game and then some. It is just story after story and several comics as well that are just breathtaking and funny and make me cry and make me think really hard. And, yeah, you're in good company, Sophie. More efficient than a guillotine is a really special story. So I feel really, really excited to have it. JD, what made you decide to submit Love Satan to Decoded?
Well, even though, SFF magazines claim that they're open to any stories we have in store for them, they're surprisingly resistant to humor. A lot of the ones I've seen, if I check their submission guidelines, they usually say we don't take humor, we're against humor, or like we have a very specific sense of humor, so take your chances with us if you have the time, or something like that. And most of my writing, not all of it, but a lot of it is pretty satirical. A lot of it I can't place in like traditional SFF magazines. And when I saw your title on tour about, and what the magazine's called and stuff like that, I was like, yeah, I think you're the right place for this, and I sent it off.
Well, we're so glad you did. We're like absolutely honored to have Love Satan in issue two, and that's a perfect segue. So, listeners, J.D. Harlock's story is called Love, Satan, and it is... It's Satan's resignation letter. And it is so funny and cheeky and clever. And I wanted to talk about humor, JD. So you totally segued for me, because it seems to me that this piece only works because of the humor in it. Do you think that's true? And if so, what do you think the humor gives us in Love Satan that we can't get? That we, if the, a version of the letter existed without the humor, we would lose.
I feel like if there was no humor in that letter, it would be unbearable for one, and it would be pretty tedious to read. I mean, I think like people would just read through it, like, we get it, like, yeah, everything sucks, you don't need to remind us. And I feel like the humor lightens that and makes you realize, like, oh yeah, that is, we've gotten to a point that is really is that bad, without just like being overwhelmingly negative.
I think it also, you're hitting at this really important time where we see people leaving work that maybe in the past was untenable, but they went and worked anyways. And as, especially in the US, and I can't speak to where y'all are located, but please feel free to chime in. You know, we have a real dearth of people who want to work at, let's say, fast food restaurants. And it's, you know, it's because like, why would I? Like, this is terrible, and I'm paid nothing, and I'm exposed to illness, and I'm treated poorly, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's this hilarious way that, you know, things are so bad, Satan is quitting, you know, like Satan is quitting. And to capture that, there's something about the timeliness of this that also makes it extra powerful. And I'm curious, was that something you like were trying to do? Or is that like a happy coincidence? Or, well, an unhappy coincidence, I guess.
No, the snapper was a reaction to Trump's presidency. The original version had more pointed references to current events, but I thought that would date it pretty quickly. And some of the references I remember were like when they elected a dead pimp in Nevada. The Republicans elected a dead pimp in Nevada over a living Democratic candidate. Or events like that. Like I would actually name them, but then I thought like it wouldn't age well in like 2-3 years. And it has been like 2-3 years since these events took place. So I'm glad I moved.
I think that was a really clever choice as like to a self edit to make it more, you know, you made it more timeless, but you also somehow made it more timely, where it's like, you know, we're seeing people, like I said, walk off jobs, not be like, you know what, screw you. You're going to be a billionaire in a C-suite and not like take care of your frontline workers. Like, why would I show up? And to see sort of like Satan be like, you know what? Fuck you guys, I'm out. Like, I don't know, that killed me. I think it's so funny.
I actually wrote another version, not like another version, a knockoff of it, where the Grim Reaper resigns. People have gotten so good at killing each other that there's just no use for him anymore. And it recently got accepted into a new magazine called The Deadlands that was crowdfunded. So yeah, I do feel like that concept resonated, that this concept resonates with people because of the environment and situation we found ourselves in.
Beautiful. Well, I can't wait to read that. I will be picking it up. Sounds amazing. Okay, so Akhil, why use a fantasy setting to talk about the abuse of a young queer Black boy / man, as you said? I'm a survivor of a child abuse. I'm also a survivor of sexual assault. And I'm curious, I've never written a fantasy story with those elements. I'm actually lying. My story that's coming in issue 2 is absolutely has some of those elements in it. But I'm curious, like, what do you think fantasy gave you, and how did you harness it to tell that story in such a, you know, emotional and potent way?
Well, there are a few things. From my own perspective of also being a survivor, to this day, have moments that I realize there are complete blocks of time that just do not exist from my childhood, where people can flash back and say, you know, when I was 10 years old, we went and we did this. And for me, they're just long, long blocks of time where I cannot pinpoint what actually happened at that stage in my childhood, because it was... it's blocked out. It doesn't exist anymore in my head. I remember saying to myself, it's like I cast a spell on myself when I was a kid and made it disappear. And so in this story, Geronimo, who is the protagonist, is brutally abused in the book. But in the story, his abuse somehow disappears, at least the language. The vocabulary that he would need to use to identify it in his mind disappears. He knows something happened. He knows something happened to him. He knows that what happened to him was horrific, but the synapses in his brain do not ignite to identify what it is. There's only sort of associated it with the sentiment that whatever it was, it's not good. And in the idea of using magic and fantasy and the elements of fantasy to make it seem to the reader that this is how something like this happens. Because in reality, so many people are doubtful that people could have PTSD, that people could block out complete moments of their lives, as if they never existed. I have a mentor who is a Vietnam veteran and suffers PTSD to this day. But people act like it doesn't exist, like it's in his mind, like it's imagination. So my idea was, well, under what context would readers be able to see that such a thing could suddenly just go poof and disappear, even though we know it exists? And I said, well, why not use magic to do so? The other reason I use fantasy is because there's a larger question of faith and religion and science and how these things sort of coexist. And yet at the same time, when we kind of change the parameters around which religion exists under the roof of a church or science exists under the roof of a laboratory, but then you take out the sort of the foundation for each one and throw it at the wall. It's all kind of fantasy as well. And the idea that, every day, we hear in the news about something happening with Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or people of faith in general. Or in another context, we hear about the latest discoveries with dark matter or with quantum physics, etc. But we don't bat an eye at it being realistic or being real. Whereas somebody casts a spell and they worship a dragon, or their friends are giants, it's fantasy. What is fantasy? Really is. What is fantasy? For me, the fantasy is that some of the biggest villains and the biggest monsters that we have in stories are not the ones that breathe fire or dwell under bridges, but the ones that we live with under the same roof, the ones that we put all of our trust and our faith in, who turned around and betrayed us and hurt us more so than anybody else could. That's the fantasy.
Well, damn, that is beautiful. And I love it. I mean, I think as a survivor myself, it just, there was so much that resonated there. And, you know, even Alec Vaid-Manon, if you're not familiar, is a trans model and activist who's non-binary and grew up in a small town in Texas and recently was writing about disassociation and how they survived by not being there. And I relate to that. Like, you know, there's all this weird shit I did as a kid that would help me numb out. And now that I've done 10 years of therapy, I know what I was doing. But children are remarkable survivors. And I see that in Geronimo.
It's strange because I know from my own personal experience that I was able to, you know, what I was saying earlier about beginning to hear your own voice. When I began to hear my own voice, I was also able to shut out other voices. Meaning that when things were happening to me as a kid, I somehow learned to block out sounds and experiences, external experiences, no matter how devastating they were, and focus on things, internal sounds and experiences that were beautiful to me. And for Geronimo's part, there's a scene that takes place where someone wants to sort of pluck whatever this trauma is that he has, that he's kind of buried deep within himself, without him being ready to do so. And his response is what I imagine anybody in that position would be. It is not for someone outside of myself to force me to deal with my trauma without me myself allowing myself to deal with my trauma first. The fact that it's sort of dressed in the skin of fantasy and magic is only just to sort of ease readers into the reality of how it actually exists in the real world, rather than just saying this is how it is. But sometimes it's easier to eat like soul food with lots of hot sauce than just no seasoning, to be honest. I'll put it that way.
That's a beautiful metaphor. Thank you. I don't want to get too much deeper because I want people to go read your story. It is something really, truly special. So thank you so much for that. Now, Sophie, I want to switch over to talking a little bit about your story. So More Efficient Than a Guillotine is this, you know, angsty, almost even ragey, tell me where I'm wrong, story. It's deeply anti-capitalist. It's deeply sci-fi. And I'm just like, where did this come from? And then beyond the genesis, how do you balance this tone of both rage or furiousness and hope, because there's a lot of hope in your story, even though it's about, you know, I'm not going to give it away, about, you know, doing some very cool stuff to people who deserve it.
That's one way to put it. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely everything you just said, all of the emotions were stirring in my head for months. Well, for years, really, ever since I was old enough to know that any ethical world would be a world where billionaires don't exist. I don't care who you are. If you're a billionaire, you're an evil monster. There's no way to amass that unbelievable amount of wealth without exploiting an unbelievable number of people along the way. And yeah, I watch as my friends lose their careers. I watch as here in Canada, the price of homes is just unbelievable. Pretty much nobody can afford a house. The kind of middle class dream is really, it's dead. It's just not attainable for anybody anymore. So yeah, I'm fucking angry about the world that was kind of robbed from us. The future that seems to be more and more dire with every passing day. And yet, yeah, there is a little twinkle of hope in there, because I mean, I'm a student of history. I did my undergraduate degree in classical studies, focused a lot on Roman history. And at the time the Roman Empire fell, in a lot of ways, it would have felt like the end of the world. You know, it's different this time around, because whereas they were facing, well, they were facing external and internal threats, whereas now the human race is, we're going to get what we deserve one way or another, whether we pull out of this or we don't make it. And we've been through existential crises before, never quite at this level, but maybe it's a certain level of species narcissism, if that makes sense, where it's just hard to imagine a world where humans aren't here, though in some ways it might be better if we weren't, for the rest of the animals around. I don't know. It's hard for me to not be hopeful. And I guess that comes back to Star Trek as well. I mean, even in that world, World War III wiped out a third of the Earth's population, and then they were like, oh shit, maybe we should do things differently. Yeah, I guess there's a lot of dire, there are reasons to be scared. There are reasons to feel like this is a very heavy, very dire time. But I don't know, it ain't over till it's over, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And there's some tension in what you said, right? Where it's like, yes, humans have become incredibly problematic on this planet. However, indigenous peoples are not responsible for that. And actually, the vast majority of us aren't, right? It is these billionaires who have corrupted and undermined the structures of our societies, even the ones that have been fucked up since the beginning, right? The U.S., we're fucked. We were founded on fuckedness. Like, until we really change some things massively, things will continue to some degree as they are. But I really think that tension is in your story, because even the defiant act of the protagonist, which again, I'm not going to give away, is an act of hope, because, you know, hopelessness leads us to inaction, not to action. And so I think that's something really powerful in that story. And I think in all of these stories, like, even Satan resigning is like an amazing action, right? Like, Satan is doing something and in the process holding up a mirror to all of us. So I, you know what? Thank you all so much for this truly remarkable conversation today. I am absolutely delighted not just to get to publish your beautiful stories, but get to talk to you. What? This is so cool. I wish we could talk for 3 more hours. So again, listeners, make sure you go check out More Efficient Than a Guillotine by S.B. Edwards, Love Satan by J.D. Harluck, and A Murder of Crows by Akhil Wingate. You can go to decodedpride.com. Make sure to buy a subscription. Yes, they are for sale. They are not for free, but if you cannot afford a subscription, please email us at editors@decodedpride.com. We have to charge, unfortunately, because we're an independent queer publication and we pay all of our authors and all of our illustrators. And so the money has to come from somewhere. And my, you know, country ass doesn't have a fortune behind me. I wish I did. And I would just publish so many queer things. But it is a delight to be here again. Thank you, JD. Thank you, Sophie. Thank you, Akil. And go read those stories. Thanks for joining us today. You can find JD Harluck on Twitter and Instagram at JD_Harluck, H-A-R-L-O-C-K. You can find SB Edwards, aka Sophie, at SB Likes Words on Twitter and on Instagram at queer.trans.writer.sophie. You can find Akil Wingate at Akil Wingate on Twitter and on Instagram at Ace McCall Music, A-C-E-M-C-C-A-L-L Music. And you can find me, S.E. Fleenor, on Instagram and Twitter at @SE_Fleenor.